Howdy, y'all. You're listening to The Managing Up Show, a podcast about leading and managing in the world of technology. I'm your host, Nicholas Means, and with me this week are Brandon Hayes.
Hello.
And Travis Swicegood.
Hey there. So this week we're going to talk about a topic that we have almost talked about countless times. Yeah, I think it might have been one of the very first things we put up on the board as like, this is a topic we should talk about. Prioritization. At some point, we describe this as our McDonald's of topics. This is the topic that you throw out. If nobody can come up with a decision for lunch, we're going to go to McDonald's. And invariably, somebody comes up with a decision. So far, every time, that's what's happened that we've thrown this out. But as we dug into some possible story ideas, we took this McDonald's and turned it into a Royale with cheese. We have a few takes on this that we think might be a little bit different than the standard, how do you prioritize what you should work on next? And to kick us off here, I'm going to throw over to Nick, who's been juggling a lot of balls and having to deal with some of that prioritization.
Yeah, so I think this topic comes across every manager's plate when you hit that point where you are at 100% utilization. You literally have something to do for every minute of your day, and there's no way you're going to get through your entire to-do list. So how do you make effective decisions around which of those balls you let drop until tomorrow or next week or forever? How do you divide these things up and make decisions that are good for your team and good for the business? What are some of the approaches that y'all have used that have worked well for you?
I can definitely describe an approach that hasn't worked. I feel like I'm that guy.
You are that guy. That's how every episode starts.
I'm sorry that I'm like Captain Trial and Error over here, but I can tell you what hasn't worked. And the angle that I keep thinking about with this is the idea of brute force. And what I mean by that is at one point at a job, I literally made a list of all the things that I felt like I was responsible for as a manager on the team. And it was literally a list of like 114 things, like 114 plates I had to keep spinning at any given time. Because when you actually delineate all the things that you do, it's always surprising. It's probably 10x what you think you're doing. And so one day I just kind of started writing down all the various irons I had in the fire at any given point. And some of these things I had to touch once a month or they'd fall over. Other things I had to touch every day or they'd fall over. But basically everything that I had to touch or I would feel like this thing is falling over, from recruiting to hiring to diversification efforts to making sure that, you know, drama in between teams was ironed out, to making sure that people were understood what their priorities were, to making sure that people had their career goals mapped out, to improving the ladder itself. So there are a wide variety of things that you're responsible for as a manager. And so sifting through that to actually sort of rank them never really felt like a useful activity for me, because I knew some of them you just do more often, some you do less often, but you can't drop any of them. And I can tell you that experiment was an abject failure. Trying to keep 113 or 114 plates spinning, where at least once a month you're touching each one of those things, is a really great way to make sure that no meaningful progress is made on basically any of them.
Yeah, I mean, clearly you have to stop at about 102, 103.
Yeah. That's where the Jenga tower falls over.
So as you went through that process, like, how did you determine what it was that you were going to say, you know what, I thought this mattered, but it doesn't?
Bankruptcy. Bankruptcy is kind of a magical thing. I was in a position where there was like a major organizational change that occurred, and it forced me to reprioritize and look at, hey, here's all the stuff that I'm doing that in the old system seemed like these were all important. Can you help me understand which of these are important? And they said no. And I was like, okay, fair enough. And just having to adjust to a wildly different, and so that could be a job change, it could be a role change, or you could self-impose this sort of bankruptcy by saying, what if I just didn't do any of this? What would actually occur? And I don't mean just like stop doing your job, but it's very difficult to discern the difference between the parts of your job that are essential and the parts of your job that are useless when they all feel equally important. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that everybody has the same affliction I do, but I know that I often wind up feeling that, where I'm sort of paralyzed by equal importance of all things.
I had a really astute HR leader tell me once that my problem was I was so zen that I couldn't figure out what was actually important. That I just approached everything with a very calm, like, okay, this is what I'm going to approach now. And so I totally feel where you're coming from there. As you were describing the bankruptcy thing, it reminded me of an old ops trick. You've got this server running that nobody knows what's going on, but you're still seeing network traffic and you can't figure out what it is. You turn it off and then listen into the room and see who starts yelling, who can't do their job. And that's one way to approach prioritization. If you really can't, if there, when you look through that list, there are some things you're like, okay, well, I have to do this and this thing. Like if you think through the, like, what's the logical next thing that happens if I don't update the credit cards for our AWS bill and all of a sudden that goes away. That's a pretty good, like, okay, well, if I'm the one that has the credit cards, I got to update that because that doesn't work well, assuming AWS is in the critical path. But for those things that you're having that question of like, well, do I really need to do this? Is it really providing some value? Sometimes stopping and seeing what happens is not a bad strategy to take in that situation.
There is a risk here, though, that I feel like we need to call out. When you start going down this bankruptcy path and stopping doing things and seeing what happens, it can lead you down a path where only the things that make noise get your attention, only the squeaky wheels. Mm-hmm. And this can lead you into this place where you're focusing on the urgent to the exclusion of the important.
I've actually engineered into my teams on purpose in this vein, and I've called it the organizational chaos monkey. It's just vacations. Make people take their vacations. Please don't be here for a week to 10 days and watch what happens. Watch all the hero stuff that you've been doing. You know, the plates are going to fall and crash to the floor, but over the course of a week or 10 days, not to an insane degree.
I can't remember the company that does this. It's been several years since I heard this. Maybe one of y'all will be familiar with the story. But there is a company out there where part of their mandatory vacation is a week that you were told to take off that you do not know is coming. And it essentially is an organizational chaos monkey where they kick you out the door with no preparation and see what balls fall on the floor. See if other people are able to step in and effectively take over your responsibilities when that happens.
Yeah, if you know that's coming, you probably behave differently.
Yeah, exactly. It creates an organizational culture around making sure that your efforts are reproducible and documented.
So now we're starting to delve into an area that when you start looking at the world through the lens of DevOps as more of a philosophy than necessarily a job skill, you start to see something that they talk about. And that's the, like, I can do this thing and I know that it's always going to do this exact thing because I've built in that traceability, that accountability, that reproducibility in my work. So if you think about that through the context of you being a manager and how do you prioritize the work that you're doing, like think about the things that you're doing. And if you didn't do them, like how is it going to affect the team? I remember the first time I took a long vacation as a manager with people reporting to me and in projects in flight, there was some questions from my boss sort of that, like, so everything's going to go okay, right? I'm like, yeah, this will be fine. And I had thought about the world and like what was going to happen through the lens of if I suddenly couldn't do this, it couldn't be here and fill my role. Is everything in place that somebody could step in and do the things that need to be done? Or am I particularly in a critical path that would keep somebody from doing their job? And I think if you're not prioritizing correctly, you can end up putting yourself in that critical path where like you're the bottleneck to making sure a deploy gets out on time, or you're the bottleneck to making sure that people have the right access that they need to do their job.
Talking about critical path, I think also gets into management style a little bit as well, because if you are managing in such a way that you're, you know, trying to put systems in place to work yourself out of a job, then there's going to be less situations like that that crop up when you're out, and it's going to give you a little bit more freedom in your prioritization. Whereas if you're in a position where you insist on reviewing every pull request before it can go out the door and things like that, then you going on vacation is a critical blocker for your team, and you getting busy is a critical blocker for your team.
As I've become more experienced, become almost lazy in a way that almost scares me. And it really does come down to really trusting the team to be able to handle the aspects of the job that exist in the critical path, which does free me up a lot to do higher level stuff around making connections to the why and bringing more of that back to the team and making sure that they're aligned with that, making sure that the higher level stuff, that doesn't mean that I'm, you know, never doing anything tactical at all, but it is a good just sort of rule or guideline that if I find myself in the critical path, I've probably messed up somewhere along the line. I do this continually. It was relatively recently where something sounded like administrative trivia, and it was like setting up Chrome Store accounts for a feature that we were shipping to the Chrome Store. And I'm like, oh, I'll handle this. And every single day they're like, Brandon's my blocker. Brandon's my blocker. And I'm like, I really don't want to be, but I'm also like doing all this other stuff. And I'm realizing I don't know how to move these Tetris blocks around in a way that unblocks the team, but also lets me get my critical path stuff done. So whenever I've found myself in the critical path, I've almost universally regretted it. If I'm between code and shipping.
Yeah, I found myself in a situation like this recently as well, where there was a thing that needed to be done to unblock the team, and I couldn't find a great path to getting it done other than just doing it myself. And a couple days later, I looked up, still in the critical path, and the bell finally went off in the back of my head, pointing out that I was in the critical path and probably shouldn't be. It was then that I took the proper course and found an organizational way to get the thing done that didn't involve me. But it took a couple days sitting in the critical path and finally feeling the pressure of being the blocker for the team to make me realize this is not a position that I need to be in.
Yeah.
This is not a good way for me to help the team.
Yeah, and you want to be helpful.
That's the thing. It always starts with wanting to be helpful, and it ends up being debilitating.
I remember taking a task once a few jobs back. We had something in the backlog that was kind of a priority, but not really. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to take this. Like, this shouldn't be a problem. But I happened to have one of those, like, the cherished free blocks in my afternoon. I had a good 3 hours. Started at 3, and I looked up at 7. I happened to be working from home that day, so I didn't have all of the usual clues to what time it was. And I looked up at 7 and was like, no, this isn't done. I'm like, okay, so what's going wrong here? And then I realized that I was like upgrading Datadog's Python implementation on Lambda so that I could get this thing that was supposed to be off the shelf that was going to be a 20-minute task running. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to put this back in the backlog and we'll let the team get to it when they get to it.
Well, and the funny thing about this is that we have all spent time coaching our teams not to do this, not to go down these rabbit holes, and we can't detect it when we do it ourselves.
No, absolutely not. And we all have different ways that we handle this stuff. So for me, I tend to subscribe to the term priority in the Merlin Mann school. Before I was a manager, before I was even a software developer, I listened to a podcast called Back to Work from its very first episode, and it really changed the way I thought about a lot of things, and one of them was about prioritization. And his whole concept of prioritization is that that's not a thing. Prioritization is not a thing because priorities is not a plural noun. That priority is like the word unique. Something can't be very unique. Something can't be high priority. Either it's the priority or it's not. And that's a little draconian, but it's a useful thought exercise to run yourself through, to think about, is this the priority right now or not? Is this driving me toward, you know, the thing that we're trying to accomplish? And I like the idea of drawing a distinction between prioritization, meaning figuring out what you should be doing, and task management, which is kind of like grooming your backlog of stuff that you could do. I use a Trello board for my task management type stuff. And I experienced a major life change recently. And I looked at my Trello board and I was like, garbage. Like, nothing that was so important to me yesterday matters today, period. That's a really instructive thing to go through and be like, okay, well, total up my last 6 months of work. Just glue it all together and say, okay, you had 6 months. What did you want to accomplish with that 6 months? And I can say I'm reasonably happy with the results of the sum total of that 6 months effort. It had a clear cohesion and purpose and mission to it that was about basically connecting a team to a business purpose and making sure that they can execute on that independently. And it went great overall. Like, I'm really happy and proud of how that played out. And so all the stuff around the individual little prioritization and all the juggling I was doing and all the absorption of additional responsibilities that muddied the water of what my priorities were, you know, with that amount of retrospect, anytime there's that major interruption or bankruptcy event, it really kind of refocuses you on what actually was important in retrospect. It would be really cool to be able to access that in the moment and not just after these major events.
Well, I think if you look at a tool like Scrum, that's not necessarily why you have a pretrospect. Like, you can't understand what's going to happen until you've done it. I recently was traveling and it did that thing. A book caught my eye at the Hudson News at the airport. And I was like, you know what? I want to pick this up and read it. And it turned into one of those things I read on the plane ride back. It was Managing Oneself by Peter Drucker. And it's two of his shorter pieces in one volume. And one of the things he talked about was the idea of setting up, like, as you set your plans for the next quarter, the next 6 months. And of course, he's looking at this through the lens of a CEO in the 50s or 60s. So 6 months is like a tomorrow type time frame once you take into account time inflation. He was saying, set up, like, these are the things I'm going to do. These are the goals I intend to have. And here's how I'm going to impact that. And then setting an appointment to go back and review that. I think that's something that, like, we as managers, we instinctively do that with our teams, just coming back to the things we instinctively do for our teams that we don't necessarily dog food for ourselves, where we say, like, let's set a plan, let's set our sprint, let's figure out what we're going to do, how we're going to do it. And then in 2 weeks, let's go back and say, how'd we do? What could we do better? What did we do great? What should we just completely blow up because this isn't working and try something different? And we do that on the almost micro scale with our teams on like a constant basis. We're constantly doing that. But it's been something that I've struggled to consistently do myself, where I set that, okay, here's the things I'm trying to accomplish organizationally with the team, the things we're trying to make sure happen, and setting the outcomes that I envision and the path to getting towards that. And then making sure that I go back and double check, hey, was I right on this? Where was I wrong? What can I learn? And how can I apply that moving forward? A theme I think we keep coming around is, we know how to do a lot of the things around prioritization and around the process to figuring out how to prioritize properly and make sure we're doing the work that we should be doing. But we tend to think about it in that like very compartmentalized way of, well, this is how software teams work and I'm not doing software development right now. So that obviously doesn't apply.
Yeah. Talking about this idea of basically personal retrospectives takes me towards Deep Work by Cal Newport. He talks a lot about building personal systems and building systems around the things that you find to be important. And that's been hugely valuable to me as a manager, building those systems so that I make sure that I'm doing the things on a regular basis that I know enable my team and I know are valuable. But one of the most valuable things from that book is the idea of a system review at the end of each month. You look at all of the systems that you've implemented, you figure out which of them are working and which of them are not, like which ones you're actively avoiding doing, and you troubleshoot them. You figure out, is this a system that I want to keep? Is it supporting something valuable? Is it not? Do I need to get rid of it? Or is it something valuable and I just need to change it so that I will actually do it? And I think that the systems approach in general and that systems review style retrospective is super valuable.
What I love about all of that is that it changes the idea of prioritization from something that you must execute correctly to something that you must have a learning system for. You have to close the loop back up. Prioritization is about learning where your priorities are by doing stuff and realizing whether it was useful or the right thing to do in that time. And it frees you up to let go of certain things. So you don't have to declare bankruptcy if you're constantly learning. So I was talking about bankruptcy as like a major learning event, right? You learn through this like major life event or major organizational change event that all the things that you thought were important aren't as important as you thought they were. But you can do that in paces and in pieces over time if you have learning tools and are disciplined about closing the loop on those.
You're talking about like having a system of learning as being the thing that's important towards prioritization. And I've been working on a podcast that's turned into listening to a book that's talking about AI and the future of computing. It's the collection of essays, Possible Minds, that was edited by John Brockman. And one of the first essays, and we can include this in the show notes. I don't remember the author's name off of the top of my head. It was a historian of computing. And he was talking about one of the big battles that was fought in the early days of computing between analog and digital. And we think of analog and digital, or when I hear that, the thing I think of immediately is, well, like the difference between a tape and the difference between a CD. But he's taking it more as the difference of a constant stream of information that you're computing over versus a binary digital zero or a one, and how early on, mostly due to the constraints of early computers, digital won out, but we're now getting to a world where that's starting to shift to this constant stream of data informing what we're doing. And this is where you get into those black boxes of the machine learning and deep learning, where something's happening. We know generally the rules that went into figuring out what that thing was, but we can't point to exactly how an algorithm came to the particular conclusion that it did based on what it's doing for an image classification or figuring out what move it's going to make in chess. We've been really good at specializing that sort of black box, more analog-like model of programming. But I wonder if the way we're approaching this process of prioritization and figuring out what we should be working on, where we should be thinking about it more as a stream of things that we could possibly be working on that's evolving, and we're kind of constantly moving it towards the right thing, but we're never going to be able to say with certainty, oh, this is exactly what I should be doing right now for every possible moment that you have something to do in. I wonder if our trying for that is us trying to impose that digital mindset of there is a zero and there is a one. There is something I should be working on and there's something I shouldn't be working on. And it's part of the historical baggage of digital computing that we're bringing along with us as managers that make us think we should be able to prioritize.
So I want to play with that a little bit because I like the direction that takes us in a little bit, where it is computing used to be really expensive and you had to really control your inputs. And so you could really focus on input and focus on putting the right things into the machine to get what you want out, because that was the thing that was expensive. The computing part was expensive. And now with machine learning and stuff, you are controlling for outputs and everything can happen in a black box because the computing aspect of it is so cheap. You could just throw more and more and more, tons and tons of resources. You know, I've worked with data science and AI teams and they don't know what's in the box. They're controlling for outputs and they're running the thing for a little while. And yes, the output was right. No, the output wasn't what we wanted. And I think prioritization can be a lot like that, where it can be very tempting to sit and focus on making sure that we're putting the right things into the machine, making sure that I'm writing the right things, making sure that I'm, you know, diagramming this system correctly, making sure that I'm designing this ladder correctly, versus just making sure that I have a system in place to adapt it. Let's say it is, you know, I decide that I care a lot about making sure that I have an engineering ladder that works for people there. I would way rather have a system that responds to change and have people get promoted, the right kind of people get promoted. Nick, you and I saw a talk by a guy named Chad Bailey recently, where he talks about people focus so much on the inputs of a hiring process of, we got to ask these questions and they got to answer them this way. And we got to surface these traits and we got to surface these experiences. And he's like, wait a minute, why don't we reverse engineer our best people and create the interview that makes them pass it, and controlling for outputs rather than inputs. There's something in there that says you could do a lot less work if you were trying, instead of trying to do the exact right set of things, if you were focusing on an outcome, you can take kind of the shortest path to get there.
Yeah. As you talk about that, the shift in what you're focusing on is a shift of the medium that you have available to you. When computing is expensive, you focus on making sure that you're using that as efficiently as possible. Same thing with storage. When you have 64K of system memory for the whole operating system and everything in your program, you're going to optimize to be memory efficient. When memory is cheap, storage is cheap, CPU is cheap, you don't have to optimize on that and you shift. I just downloaded an update to Xcode today and out of curiosity, looked to see how much I was downloading. And sure enough, it was over 6 gigs that I was downloading over Wi-Fi to update one program. And it happened in the background over the course of 10 minutes or so. And I didn't even notice it. Didn't even really have an impact on my machine because now we don't need to optimize for that. Like we did back in my BBS days where like, I remember, well, you know what, this is one floppy drive worth of stuff. So here goes 20 minutes while I wait for this to download. Don't even think about the time it took to actually install the stuff once you had it. So I wonder if that's part of like what happens as you move out of an engineering role into a management, you start looking for like, what are my constraints? And one of them is time. Like you only have so much time. So like, well, how do I use my time most effectively? And now we're focused very tactical on what is at the end of the day, a strategic problem. It's strategic how you spend your time and the things you choose to focus on and the impact you're going to have by the way you choose to spend that time. But it's really easy to kind of get sucked into that rabbit hole of, well, I only have so much time. So how do I carve up my day and block out my calendar just right so that I can get all the things done that I need to get done? Because, well, here's a list of my 114 things. And I don't know what I could actually drop. They all seem really important.
I like that. And it made me think, God, Nick, can we talk about calendars for a second? Yeah. Can we talk about priorities and calendars as managers? Because every manager I know, like I showed a slide at a conference talk once that showed my calendar. It was a literal picture of my calendar. And everybody goes, oh my God, I feel so seen. And it's like, all I did was show you a picture of my calendar. And everybody went, oh my God, it's a dagger to my heart.
I always love it when somebody on my team gets a glimpse of my calendar and they're like, oh my gosh, how do you deal with your calendar? And it's like, well, you know, I'm kind of at this point in life where one of my chief job activities is talking to people. And a calendar is one of the ways that you accomplish that. Now, the challenge is that you do have to have those blocks of uninterrupted time. Because if all you're doing is having conversations, then you're not actually doing the further out, long thinking things that are going to really help your team excel over a long period of time. You're just dealing with the current business. So you got to have a mix of both. You can't have a calendar that's completely saturated with meetings.
But you do, But everybody does. That's a thing that happens. Your calendar is your boss at a certain point. Everybody goes through this. This is a phase of your career as a manager that your calendar is your boss. You're miserable. You don't know what to do. And you don't know how to say no to things.
I think this is where your system thinking comes back into play. To go back to talk about deep work a little bit, that's something that Newport actively does. His calendar is like, you know what? Here's 2 weeks that I'm completely unavailable. Go ahead and try to book that meeting. It's going to be auto declined because he has the system in place to say, this is where my priorities are. And this is the thing I'm going to be working on. So you're right. There is a point where it takes over and definitely runs your day. And you're just like, okay, let me look at my phone and see what room I'm supposed to be in next for the next meeting. But the other side of that, once you get through it, if you get through it, and I've worked with some people who've had pretty lofty titles who haven't quite got to the other side for some reason or another. But when you get to the other side of it, you realize that that's actually the tool that you can use to control how you're spending your time and to signal the prioritization that you're giving to the rest of the company. I remember talking with you once about a former CEO of yours, Brandon. They went against all norms of openness that you would see right now in a company, like, oh yeah, we're completely open book, transparent. Every calendar is completely available. And they had their calendar closed explicitly so people couldn't just start picking off parts of it. It was kind of a shot in the dark. Hey, I need to talk to you. Does this time work to provide that flexibility?
Another hack that I accidentally discovered was creating a week where I just cancel all my regularly scheduled stuff. One-on-ones, sorry, this week we're not doing one-on-ones. I'm not doing the normal meetings that I go to, the status update meetings, the recruiting meeting, all the stuff that I might normally do in a week. There was a special set of circumstances for the engineering team that week, and we decided not to do anything. And so I canceled every single meeting I was going to be in that week. And I said, I'm going to try to accomplish a bunch of stuff this week, and I'm going to let the chips fall where they may. And it was amazing. It was so therapeutic to realize that the earth didn't collapse in the week that I canceled every single meeting. And I actually had the most productive week, even though I didn't say, okay, I'm going to sit down and buckle down and I'm going to work on these projects. It wasn't working through a backlog. It was just realizing the noise level dies down and you suddenly can hear some signal. And I think people with really jam-packed calendars should seriously consider what would happen if you just said, hey, these things that we normally do every week, there's going to be a week in the future where we're not doing that. It would be great to create a distraction for the team in the form of I've had workplaces where that have a tech debt week or a hackathon week or something like that, where the managers, it's like a free for all. And real magic happened that week. I actually was able to glue together things in the organization that had been broken for a really long time and make probably more actual meaningful progress on that 6 month time horizon stuff in the course of a week than I'd made in the previous 6 weeks.
A slightly less dramatic approach is something I've been doing. So I recently started a new job and am in the process of setting up all of those recurring check-in meetings and things like that and figuring out what needs to be on the calendar. And just today, I put a weekly check-in with a team member on the calendar and we're like, how much do we really need this? Does this need to be weekly, every other week, once a month? Like, what's it becoming? I'm like, well, let's do it every week because I'm sure we can come up with something to talk about for 30 to 45 minutes every week, but let's only set it to recur for a month. And then in 4 weeks, we've got to determine, okay, what value are we getting from this? And now we have to we've set up the environment so that we have to take that next step. So many recurring check-ins, mm-hmm. I am 100% guilty of this too. You set up the recurring schedule. When does it stop? And so you never have that moment to question, hey, is this still useful? So when you're looking to set up some of those meetings, especially if you're not 100% sure that you're going to need this or how long you're going to need this or how long the context of this meeting is going to be important, another way that you can sort of set that up, set yourself up in the future is to say, all right, we're going to say that this is going to go on for 4 weeks or 6 weeks or 6 months. Pick a time that seems to make sense and sunset that meeting so that it doesn't pop up on the calendar. And as you're looking through it, you're either going to realize as you get to the end of it, oh wait, this is supposed to end. Let's make sure we extend this. Or maybe the meeting goes away and it wasn't as something that you absolutely needed to get done. So it provides both of those situations. When you get to that point on Thursday afternoon, where you're like, man, I feel like I'm supposed to be doing something. Look at my calendar. Well, I don't have anything to do. Let me look at last week. Oh wait, that was that meeting. And that gives you that built-in reflection point. And we were talking about going in and reviewing your systems and making sure that they work. This is a way you can use the system against itself.
So I want to shift us to something else. Can we talk about procrastination?
Can we put it off for just a little bit?
Yeah, there's some other stuff I want to do first. I have a crochet project I was planning to work on first.
So I think procrastination is an interesting thing to talk about when it comes to prioritization, because inevitably there is that one item on your to-do list that continues getting pushed off into the future and into the future and into the future. And one of the things that I have learned in the last year or two is that those items often have signal. Anytime I'm feeling serious procrastination about a task, it's usually because there's something about it I don't understand, there's information I need, or there's something about it that I'm ashamed of. Like I've not done it. I should have already done it. And so I'm just going to keep ignoring it so I don't have to feel more ashamed about it. Do y'all have any of that experience?
Never once ever have I self-reflected and realized that, oh, wait, that was the reason I was putting something off. No, that happens to me all the time, especially those tasks that like tend to snowball in your mind as to like, do I need to do this? Do I need to do this? Like, do I need to do that? Well, okay, how do I start? And figuring out that first step can be hard. I have had a little bit of a success in fighting back against that by trying to apply a lot of the principles of Tim Allen's Getting Things Done, or GTD, where it is, okay, here's the big thing I want to accomplish. What's the literal next minimum thing that I could do to move towards that?
Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever felt more of a failure as a human than when I tried to apply all the principles of getting things done. It's so much. But I love the bit that you just called out.
So I think that one of the problems with GTD as a thing, and the book is one of those books you read through, like, oh yeah, this intuitively makes so much sense. My life would be so much better if I just did all of these things. And then you go download OmniFocus or something like it and try to apply it and spend 6 weeks getting it all set up. I say, as a guy who's rereading for the second or third time, the Creating Flow book about OmniFocus, which is several hundred pages just about using the application so that you can get things done, which in and of itself feels like some sort of form of procrastination. But when you look at it as a whole, it does seem completely insurmountable, but it's just like looking at Scrum as a whole. If you look at all the things you got to do with Scrum, all the backlog grooming, the backlog that like, here's a line of work that we could be doing that's been properly prioritized and it completely fleshed out and all the things we've got. Here's the retrospectives that we're going to have that, like, really, honestly, we look in the mirror and take a look at what we're doing and how we're doing it and really shape that and mold that. All of those things that go on, it can seem overwhelming, especially if you're not doing any of them, or you're only doing part of them, or you're doing part of them, but as you research the process, you realize, oh, well, we thought we were doing retrospectives, but we're not. We're just talking about what we shipped. We're not talking about the process, or we're never talking about what we ship. All we do is talk about process and what the best task tracking tool is. That can seem overwhelming. The kicker on any of those is to, like, grab that chunk that you can, and it's almost a prioritization. Like, figure out what that thing is that you can take as that next step that helps move the ball forward to start the process, and realize that the next process is that review. Looking at GTD and Scrum, like, two of the things that, like, in both of those systems that you're absolutely supposed to do, no questions asked, is in Scrum, the retrospective. So let me review the work and how we're doing it and where are the areas that we can be better. And in GTD, it's the review. Like, let's review all the tasks that I have in flight, all the projects that I have in flight. You don't have to do it at every review, review absolutely everything, but you need to have some sort of process in place to make sure that those are coming back and you're evaluating them. And that comes back to that continual learning process. I think it's interesting that two different groups of people solving different problems, Alan was focused squarely at the C-suite and how do we make executives more efficient. And the Scrum group was focused very explicitly on how do we make development more efficient, coming out of the Agile manifesto movement. Both of them ended up with the one thing that you can't scrimp on is that process of reflection.
Coming back, I like the reflection angle, that it is absolutely essential. I like tools that kind of encourage you to reflect. But coming back to your larger point too about this, Nick, is I like how you separated procrastination reasons into categories, because you said there's signal in it. And the signal could be, you know, hey, maybe you don't have the right process and you're not doing the right kind of reflection and things are just carrying over because you don't have a process to reflect and you don't realize this is happening. But there are other signals in there. And like you mentioned, shame is as one of them. Like, I feel ashamed that I'm supposed to have done this. And I think there's something really meaty in there that when I look back and I'm pulling up my ancient items in my Trello board, and so, which itself is the result of me compromising on something. I felt like I should set up some sort of GTD workflow. And I was like, I can't set up OmniFocus. I can't afford that in my life right now. I'm just going to set up a Trello board because I know I can click a button and create three columns for, you know, backlog, doing, and done. And I'm looking at my backlog right now. And one of them is a thing that I heard from you, Travis, about looking into portfolio for Jira. And in the course of spending a year, this is from June 14th, 2018. So we're rolling up on a year ago where I felt like I should be doing this. And it was just sitting there mocking me. Like, well, I know I don't love Jira. I know that additional project management or portfolio management tooling on top of Jira feels horrible to me. This isn't something I want to do for a living. This doesn't feel like it should be my job or I want it to be my job, but I felt like it's supposed to be at this point. And so if I'm completely honest, I look at this and there's this task in my backlog that's like, hi, I'm about to make your life less like the life that you want it to be, but it's something you're supposed to do. And of course, that's going to carry over week to week, month to month, quarter to quarter. And then literally last week, I had talked to my boss about it and said, hey, I think I just realized here's a tool that we could probably replace with a strategic set of conversations once a month. And here's what we're trying to actually accomplish. He's like, yeah, we don't need that tool. We could just do this with conversations. Great. And I got to check the thing off my list. And it had been just sitting there mocking me for a year, making me feel bad about myself. So I couldn't apply like creative thinking to it because I was backed into a corner by letting this thing kind of make me feel like there was a part of my job I'm supposed to do that I don't want to do, that I don't know how to do. I don't even want to learn. No offense, Jira, you know, fans and portfolio by Jira fans. It just wasn't applicable to my job when I actually applied creative thinking to the problem. And I think there are lots of times when we find ourselves procrastinating about things, we kind of get a little bit triggered and we get into this like little bit of a fight or flight response about a task. And it takes away the creativity that we might use to creatively solve that problem a different way.
I wonder if that comes down to writing like what the task was that you added to your backlog. The task was, here, let me read up on this particular tool, and not the core, like what cost. Like, yeah, as an engineer, yeah, I hate when a product manager gives me a ticket that says, hey, go do this thing, implement this library, use this third-party tool to solve this problem that I need solving, and not like, here's what I'm trying to do. Like, how do we go about solving that?
Right. But I was the jerky product manager, right? I was the one saying, you need to do this way because you heard this is the way to solve this problem. And then I forgot about the problem.
Here's the thing. We are the jerky product manager to ourselves. Absolutely. We do this to ourselves all the time. Mm-hmm. So how do we do this with more compassion? How do we prioritize our tasks with more compassion for ourselves and help ourselves be more productive?
I think one very compassionate thing to do for yourself, and this is like every one of us has done this with team members, I'm absolutely positive. You tell your team member, hey, you don't need to do that. It's okay if that doesn't happen. And I think that's something we need to get comfortable with ourselves. Just because something makes it into the backlog doesn't mean that it needs to get done. And if you're in a situation where the backlog is overwhelming, where it is starting to be a point of concern or panic or causing anxiety to yourself, like come up with some, figure out, like investigate that and figure out what are the rules I can put around this. So if I have something that's sitting in the backlog that I keep deferring and pushing down, well, I'll get to that next week. Well, I'll get to that next week. What's the rule for when you say, okay, I've pushed that long enough. I'm just going to delete it. It'll come back if I need it.
Yeah, that's a 37 signals principle that from way back in the day, that anytime you get a feature request from a customer, just because you get it once doesn't mean you should do mm-hmm. something about it. And that thinking is pretty valuable when you start looking at your own personal task list. If you're trying to figure out what of these tasks can I declare bankruptcy on, cross off, and not think about, that's a good heuristic. Which of these would nobody notice if I just didn't do? Or which of these is safe for me to just cross off my list and not do and wait on them to come back up?
As a user of OmniFocus, one thing I found really valuable when I have a task that I'm getting ready to, yeah, I don't need to do that. I added it to my inbox. When I went back to review it a couple of days later, I realized, oh yeah, I don't need to do that. Open up the note field and write out why. I'm not going to do this because this new thing has happened, or I now have this context that I didn't have. And that process of like explaining, I'm the only one that sees my OmniFocus. To OmniGroup's detriment, they still don't have a way to share that darn thing. Like, we're going, what, 15 years in now, and I still can't share OmniFocus with another person. Maybe that's a good thing. But when I write that note, I'm the only one that's ever going to see that, and I'm probably never going to review it again. But I've gone through that process to say, all right, like, here's why this is getting, why I'm getting ready to mark this as complete, even though I didn't do it, or why I'm getting ready to delete it and put it in the trash.
Yeah, that's one of those great principles from GTD that actually is useful. The act of writing it down gets it out of your head and makes you quit thinking about it.
Yep. I like that capture idea of it. And capturing doesn't mean doing. And capturing isn't an instruction to do in the future. It's just a thing that says, it's a signal that says, here's a thing I feel like I should be doing. You asked how we could have more compassion for ourselves in this situation. And one of the tricks that I learned running a software consultancy a few years ago was, people feel like they really want to be up in your business telling you what you should be doing when you are a consultant. And the way that you can push back on that very, very simply is to say, here is what we did. And you really are actually taking the burden off of the person who doesn't want to have to tell you what to do, but feels like they're supposed to. And you go, no, we're just going to tell you what you did. And then you tell us what to do differently next time. And there's only a week lag in between each update. So once a week, I would sit down and write down, here's what we accomplished this week. Here's what we delivered for you. Here's what we think we're going to do next week. Here's what we need from you. If you need anything else, if you want to change any of this, let me know. And that weekly check-in bought us all the freedom and leeway to work however we wanted to work all the time. It was the coolest consultancy life hack I'd ever seen in my life, because it meant the difference between being dictated to and dictating. And that was a way to be compassionate to ourselves by signaling, here is, just on a week-to-week basis, and maybe it doesn't need to be week-to-week, it certainly doesn't need to be day-to-day, week-to-week, sprint-to-sprint, or month-to-month, have some idea of, here is what we actually accomplished. Here's what I actually did. Here's what I actually moved forward. Here's where I focused my energy. Here's where I plan to focus my energy. And you may have a boss that cares about that in that level of detail. And you may have a boss that does not give a crap. But being able to kind of circle yourself and have, like, that's my moment of reflection, to sit down at the end of the week and say, here's what I actually did with my time. I probably did 100 things, but here's the one thing I actually moved forward, or the three things I actually moved forward this week. And there's power in that, to be able to kind of turn it into a narrative or a story about what you actually are attempting to accomplish.
Yeah, and I think, circling back, I can't remember which one of you made this point earlier, but the idea of there not being priorities, they're just being priority. One of the things that's been the most helpful for me, a ritual that I've developed, is at night, before I go to bed, I think about, what is the one thing that if I got it done tomorrow would let me feel like tomorrow was a successful day? And I get generally more than just that thing done, but it's very freeing to have this idea that there is one critical task that if I can just get this one thing done, then I've moved the most important thing I can possibly move forward.
And that's way closer to the truth than feeling like you were supposed to do 50 things in a day. Yeah. Because to all outside concerned people and the organization as a whole, really on more of like a week-to-week basis, you could not come into work for 4 days. And if you did the one thing that mattered that week, and I've actually told this to people that I manage before, like, you put so much pressure on yourself, especially when I manage people that put a lot of pressure on themselves. You put so much pressure on yourself to deliver constantly all the time to the highest degree. And really what the organization cares about is, you know, did you have the win this week? Did you get that one thing over the line that you were supposed to do this week, or let's say a sprint, you know, in a 2 week period of time? And everything's cool if you did that. Everything else is icing on the cake, and things that you learn and things that you do and additional value you bring. But there's really like the one thing in a given week. And if you could do it once a day, that's even better. But even just once a week, like, you could just have had a complete Monday through Thursday catastrophe. And then on Friday, you do the one thing that you know, like, really moved the needle on something, and the week was salvaged. Like, that's a very real thing. And I think people underestimate that to their own detriment, because we put more pressure on ourselves than our organization would even put on us.
So one of the things you called out there, Brandon, is this idea that there's one critical task that you can do for the whole week, and that's the only thing that people outside of you really care about. And I think that's an important call out, because as we look at our to-do lists, a lot of the things that are on there, we are the only person in the entire organization that cares about that particular bullet item on our to-do list. So I think one of the most important ways to frame this up is in terms of impact. What are the things that are on your to-do list that you know are moving organizational and business goals forward? What are the things that have tangible impact in terms of the people on your team being able to do their jobs, in terms of the people above you having the information they need to do their jobs? I think that's as we try to prioritize and as we try to figure out what that most critical thing is, we have to try to figure out what of the things on our to-do list are the things that are going to move the ball forward.
Yeah, I think you just hit the nail on the head. This entire conversation about prioritization has skirted around the main point of the whole reason we're doing this is to have some sort of impact and making sure that what we're doing is maximizing that. I mean, that's the metric to prioritize against.
This is what you would do as a manager for somebody else, but we always give ourselves short shrift, right?
Absolutely.
Well, I think this wound up being a really fruitful discussion, and it did turn into a royale with cheese after, you know, calling this like the McDonald's topic. I think there was a lot of really important stuff there that is going to give me something to reflect on over the coming weeks, especially around how we deal with procrastination and, you know, trying to do 50 things when really maybe there's really just one that actually matters tomorrow. So I want to think about that. I'm going to roll that over in my mind, and it's likely going to change the way that I look at stuff in the future. So thank you both very much for that discussion. For everybody listening, thank you for joining us, and we hope you got something out of it as well. As always, we are at Managing Up Show on Twitter. You can get at us there, or you can get at us individually. I'm Tev Viking on Twitter.
I'm N Means on Twitter.
And I am T Swiska just about everywhere.
If you like the show, the best way you can help us, as always, is to share it with your friends, to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. Again, you can tweet at us at Managing Up Show. Thanks again for joining us. Have a great week, and we will see you again soon.
Bye, everybody.
See ya.